Hi, it's Brian Rose, and welcome to London Real. If you're listening to this podcast, it means that you're excited about learning and creating real change. Well, me too. That's why I started broadcasting this show 8 years ago. And over that time, I've learned that change only happens when you take action. Maybe you've been thinking about what steps you could take in order to live a better life, but you're feeling stuck or don't know where to start. I understand, and that's why I created the London Real Academy, to help people take that first step towards everything from starting their own business to recording their first podcast to speaking publicly or just to leading a healthier, more productive lifestyle. And today, I'm offering you a free one-to-one phone call with one of my London Real Academy coaches who can speak with you directly about your personal challenges and how we can help. There is no cost for this and no obligation. So if you're ready to take action, go to londonreal.tv/change or click on the link to book your free coaching call and start your journey today. Now, on to the show. The world is changing. Inspiration is everywhere. It has never been so easy to connect, share, and bring people together. We're learning from others and finding the best in ourselves. Challenging our beliefs. Sharing our vulnerability. Overcoming our fears. Transforming ourselves so we can transform the world. How far can we go?
This is London Real. I am Brian Rose. My guest today is...
This is London Real. I am Brian Rose. My guest today is Professor Michael Levitt, the biophysicist, author, and lecturer. In 2013, you received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for the development of multi-scale models for complex chemical systems, and you are currently a professor of structural biology at Stanford University. Your early predictions on the spread of COVID-19 went dramatically against mainstream opinion, and yet they are now described as being remarkably accurate. You've also criticized the use of lockdowns as a medieval weapon to combat the pandemic, saying they cost more lives than they save. Professor Levitt, welcome to London Real.
Thank you very much. Glad to be there, George.
It's great having you here. First of all, I just want to announce that we're streaming now on our brand new Digital Freedom Platform, which is a censorship-free independent broadcasting system that is of the people, by the people, for the people, and available exclusively on our website at freedomplatform.tv. Can everyone watching us now please share this link via the sidebar to all of your social media channels? Just ask your friends and family to give us 15 minutes and then they can decide. Professor, I pledge to you and everyone watching us that none of this conversation will be edited, censored, removed, or banned, and that anyone in the world can watch the full version of this episode free at londonreal.tv/Levitt. Thanks to the generous donations of over 32,000 people around the world that I affectionately call the London Real Army. For anybody wanting to become a founding member of the Digital Freedom Platform, they can go to freedomplatform.tv/give to donate and fight with us on the front lines to protect our human rights. At London Real, we've been a platform for free speech since 2011. And Professor, I'm excited to have you here today. You know, I looked at an article the LA Times wrote in March 23rd, and it was quoting you was saying, we're going to be fine. And I think, you know, now in June, people forget how back in March, everybody in the world was terrified. We thought that this was going to be, you know, something that was going to literally decimate the world. And yet you were bold enough to make a statement back then. You know, why did you make that statement then? And how do you have the confidence to stick your head up and say something like that? Because in the scientific community, you were probably one of the very few saying this.
So I would say, firstly, you know, late March, a long time ago, but I had been involved in this since late January. So late March was like the end of month two for me. And because I'd seen what happened in China, in Wuhan, in the rest of China, I realized that this was a virus that in some way was self-limiting. And we can say more about that later. The other thing is that by looking at various examples of places that were hit very early on, but hit very hard, we got some estimate of what I call the population fatality rate, i.e., forget about cases, forget about infections, just ask if you have 1 million people, how many of them are likely to die? And the numbers that we saw were sort of more than flu, but maybe not more than 50% more than flu. So in that sense, since flu was a very dangerous disease, a bad disease, corona was accepted, it didn't see any way in which a disease that was sort of comparable, that was in any way burning itself out, was going to do a lot of damage. So actually, when I said that, I really felt confident because the numbers that I'd had by then, there were a lot of numbers. And Italy was almost reaching a corner at that point, which was a terrible. I mean, Italy was the first pandemic or epidemic that really was out of control. So, looking back, it doesn't seem like I was particularly brave. I was surprised by the headwind that I got into. And generally, I was, my explanation is that everyone was panicked and wasn't thinking straight because people were very upset with me, oftentimes my scientific colleagues.
You know, that must be strange for you as a scientist and, and a researcher and an educator to go into the political storm like this. I mean, again, you were looking at the numbers and analyzing this from a scientific basis. You probably never have ever jumped into such a maelstrom.
That's true, but I'm also a very apolitical person in the sense that, I go and watch a tennis match and I don't really care who wins. I mean, I love the game. Or I'll go and watch football or soccer versus rugby. And I like the game, but I'm not a very tribal person. So for me, it was very difficult because, especially in the USA, where I was invited onto Fox and I was invited onto CNN, and they really only wanted me to say what they wanted to say. So that was actually a little bit of a surprise. But after a while, you get the hang of it and you realize that one thing I had to explain is that the numbers are very, very honest things. People always talk about the numbers being forged or whatever. You can usually tell very easily if a number has been tampered with because there are certain self-consistency things that go on. And as I got more and more used to numbers from all different places, I realized that the numbers are all telling the same story. And, that gives you a feeling that, you can interpret the numbers in one way or the other way. But we basically took a very simple approach. I should also say that the work of my entire career has been with dynamic trajectories, essentially how things move. And in some ways, an epidemic is a dynamic object. I mean, it's the number of infected people starts low, goes high, it stops, and so on. So kind of they're almost like equations of motion that epidemics can adopt. And if you sort of learn a little bit about the beginning, like if you see a football on a certain trajectory, you can sort of guess where it's going to go to. And that's sort of what happens with an epidemic as well.
Interesting. And so you were looking at kind of total deaths when everyone else was focusing kind of on deaths related to COVID-19. And so they were seeing this kind of geometric progression, but you were looking overall and saying, this actually isn't geometric. It's something, like you said, looks
well,
like...
I can explain it very easily. So the one of the very confusing things about epidemiology is that they use this RT number, the R number as a function of time. And it is a really, really hard number to calculate. Because basically you say that the number of cases today depends on the number of cases yesterday and the number of cases the day before, because a person can infect, say, for a whole week or 2 weeks. So it's a very complicated sum of all the previous cases multiplied by some set of unknown numbers. So it's a very uncertain number. In an epidemic, the total number of cases or the total number of deaths is a well-defined number. If, for example, you look at the number of new deaths or new cases, it turns out that in the Western world, there's a huge kind of periodicity that comes from the day of the week. There are usually very few cases on Sundays and lots of cases on Fridays because people take the weekend off and they don't count the cases and deaths. So, but the total is more or less reliable. So the thing I did at the very beginning, and it seemed like a very obvious thing to do, but going forward, it's actually been kind of sensible. You take the number of cases today, the number of cases yesterday, and you divide the number of cases today by the number of cases yesterday. So let's say there were 100 cases yesterday and 120 cases today. That gives you 120 divided by 100 is 1.2. That basically tells you that the number of cases has increased by a factor of 1.2 or by 20%. Okay? So that sort of says that if it's growing, it's growing at 20% a day. You can do this with your bank interest or anything like that. Now, if things are really growing exponentially, you'd expect to get that same factor the day before yesterday and also tomorrow. So now you can wait a day and then take the number of today to Bob had the number yesterday and get the number. And what you find very, very quickly everywhere is that that ratio is getting less and less and less. So if on day 10, the number of cases is growing by 30% a day, then on day 11, it's growing by 28% a day. And day 12, it's growing by 26% a day. And you get this very steady decrease. And this is something which is not what you expect from exponential growth. If you, you know, when you put your money in the bank, that's exponential growth. Compound interest is exponential growth. But you know, you sort of expect, if they're giving you 10% a year, you don't expect to get 10% and then 9% and then 8%. And if you did, you wouldn't get very much money after 10 years. So basically, you see this in all the viral growth. And that was a surprise to me because it indicated that right from the very beginning, and I think in China, I started looking at the numbers in day 10. There was only data for 10 days at the end of January. But to see this same decrease. Now, you have to be careful because if you have a very small number, say you have 5 cases a day and 8 cases tomorrow, then you'd say, well, 8 divided by 5 is 1.6. But 8 and 5 are such small numbers that you wouldn't believe that. If it was 80 divided by 50, you'd feel more confident. So you have to sort of wait a bit until you have, say, 100 cases. But then this measure works really well. And what we've seen everywhere, this number just gets lower and lower. And we've now found mathematical properties of this number. It actually, you know, there's all sorts of things about it that everyone is now plotting. And it basically relates to a distribution that comes from a British scientist 200 years ago called Gompert. And he had this distribution to describe how people get old. And essentially, this is a distribution where every day the bank pays you less interest. And it's a little bit like you get, and this is actually what's happening to, and everywhere COVID is described by this. So for this reason, the problem with COVID is the spread. Because clearly, even if, let's say London has an epidemic, you probably can't really control what's happening in London. By the time you have, say, 1,000 cases in London, you probably have it spread everywhere. But you can stop it going from London to Manchester by just simply saying, no trains, no planes, no cars, nothing. And that would be useful to slow down the time it gets to Manchester. But actually in London, it's not going to make too much difference what you do because everyone's infected. And even then, it's very hard to stop people living in the same town from not infecting each other. And this is the reason lockdown doesn't really help. I mean, social distancing is a good idea. I was just reading that in England, one of the major benefits was just washing your hands and maybe wearing a mask, you know, practicing better hygiene. Washing your hands is not a big deal. But I think that there's something very strange about lockdown. I must say, I was shocked that any country adopted lockdown. The Chinese did it because they were very confused. They didn't really know what was going on. And they probably succeeded too well, because although in the province of Hubei, where there are 60 million people, sort of the size of Italy, the infection spread quite well. Outside Hubei, there were only 13,000 cases. So that means in a population of 1.3 billion people, they had 1,300 cases. And this means that there must be very, very little infection among that population. So this is a problem because there's no reason why it shouldn't start up again in mainland China. They can probably keep restrictions, and people there are very good at wearing face masks and having their temperature monitored and stuff like that. But you know, we a very important thing about this epidemic is what is the end point? And you know, all this discussion about was lockdown important in England, was it not important? Again, the trouble with lockdown, it's obviously an effective measure, certainly, if you took everyone on, if the day we heard about the epidemic in China, we had locked up every single person in England, there would be no infection. I mean, you can't get an infection if you don't see anybody. But that might have not been a good idea, because if you don't have a vaccine, you want people to get infected. And anyway.
Two questions about that. When you see that lack of geometric progression, and like you said, maybe it goes from 20% to 18% to 16%. I mean, that tells you something about COVID-19 as a disease. You know, and we know it's highly contagious, but is it also telling you that for some reason it seems to kind of fade out after a while? I mean, I know you're not an immunologist per se, but what does that tell you about COVID-19?
I think what it tells you is that as there are more cases, it's harder and harder to find somebody to infect. And that's what it really means, because, you know, if every day you could find new people to infect, then you could, nothing should stop you growing. And the reason is probably, I mean, there are a number of possible explanations, none of which I think are determined yet. So one explanation involved asymptomatic cases. So this would mean, let's say I'm the infected case, and on day one, I get infected, but my three brothers also get infected, but I don't know they're infected, and they don't know they're infected. So maybe I don't feel so good, so I sort of stay at home, I'm careful, but they're feeling great, they're out on the town. They're infecting people without knowing it. Then when I sort of feel a bit better, I want to go and infect somebody, they've all been infected. Now, that explanation depends on having asymptomatic cases being infectious. The World Health Organization released something that they want, although apparently it's not actually correct, and I'm not going to go into that. Another explanation would be that some fraction of the population already has some immunity to COVID. Now, you might say, well, how is that possible? I mean, you know, this is a new virus, except that it's coronavirus, and half the viruses that cause just regular good old common colds are also coronaviruses. So people are now also finding, immunologists, that there's some potential cross-reactivity, or perhaps that the immune system is primed to be able to make antibodies to corona very easily. The bottom line is that in every major epidemic, every major outbreak, things have eventually burnt themselves out. And you could claim, but I don't think that would be true, that they've all been managed very well. But then, you know, you have Northern Italy, you have Spain, you have the United Kingdom, New York City. These didn't give one the impression of being very well managed, especially when they were finding out that most of the infected people had been infected before they were locked down, that the subways and tubes had helped spread the disease. And when you look at all those people, you find that the number of people who have died, and I don't think death is important, but it's a proxy for how many people are infected. We can't measure infection, and it seems that, although most of the deaths are people who are older, nobody is able to protect anybody particularly well. So deaths are a proxy for how much infection. In any case, the level of infection we get to is about 500 per million, which is 5 per 10,000. It's 0.05% of the population. So it's about a half per thousand. Now, this means that for Italy, you expect something like 30,000 deaths. For England, maybe the same sort of number. What's interesting is that Sweden, which definitely hasn't practiced medieval lockdown, they've used some level of common sense social distancing, also looks like it's getting to the same number. For Sweden, the number would be 5,000 or 6,000 per 10 million. So it's, again, we're all getting this number. Now, New York City is a bit of an exception, because in New York City, the number of people who have died is closer to 1,200 per million, even 1,500. And, you know, I don't know. It's hard to tell. I think we see some interesting things in the numbers. So, for example, in an area that we've analyzed, a very large area, is all of Europe. Basically, you know, we, with this set of data, you analyze the data where you find it. You just look under the lamppost. You can't go out and collect data. But in Europe, there's a very good organization called Euromomo. MOMO is Monitoring of Mortality. And they basically count total deaths from every country every week, and they update it every Thursday. So probably by now there's a new one. And when you look at the Euromomo, what you find is that there's a peak that corresponds to COVID. It was also a peak that corresponded to influenza 3 years ago. If you look at the people who have, the extra people, if you like, who've died during the COVID peak, you find that only 8% are under 65 years old. If you look at the mortality figures in New York, it's more like 30%. That's a huge difference. And, you know, it may be due to obesity. It may be due to the lack of a universal health system. It may be due to poverty. I think, I would guess, but I don't really know, that New York is a city that probably has very big extremes of income. There are some really, really rich people there and some quite poor people. So these things all could give you this. Also, there's a lot of older people living in nursing homes. I mean, New York City, in some ways, up the East Side, is a great place to be old. You know, great museums, you can walk everywhere. And as a result, I think they have a very, quite a number of aging people. But it's still surprising. The same number is actually true in other US locations as well. So, you know, we're studying this, but there's just a limit to how much I can do. But it makes me feel that essentially what's happening with COVID is that in every population is a certain number of people who are susceptible, not susceptible in terms of the disease, but are vulnerable in terms of being infirm, having other conditions. You know, I often think about it as a forest, and there are some trees that are just getting kind of old, broken.
Yeah.
If a big wind comes through, those are the trees that are going to fall. And that's what seems to happen.
Talk about the age, because you've been, you know, very vocal about, first of all, highlighting that a lot of these cases are older. And obviously there are the comorbidities, and also how we don't seem to discern between a 20-year-old life and an 85-year-old life. And the fact that the marginal gain of keeping an 85-year-old, you know, alive one more year is obviously a significant cost. Can you just talk a little bit more about your thoughts on that?
So it seems to me to be obvious. And what surprised me was that people thought I was being really, really cruel. And I would say to people, okay, so, you know, I'm 73 years old. I'm very aware that I've had 73 great years. You know, I have a 16-year-old grandson. He's out of school. He's in California. You know, his life is being endangered for me. And I kind of often see this thing in terms of the young versus the old. I'm a baby boomer, was born in 47, had it really good. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, everything was opening up, easy to get into college, easy to get a job. You know, we didn't have to compete with the generation above us because they hadn't really made it. And we had the best music. We had, you know, everything was coolest. And we've got to remember that we're no longer, you know, we still think we're the greatest thing on earth. But the fact is that all those young generations are the future. And I think there was a little bit too much emphasis on this. People will say I'm obviously wrong, but a lot of young people, you know, will call me a granny killer. Now, my mother actually lived in London, and she's 105 years old. She's actually fine. I check her by Apple FaceTime quite often. But I still think that if we in a society, it is very self-serving for the old to think that they are more important than the young. Insurance companies handle this very well. If I want life insurance, no one will give it to me. They're going to say, 73? You think we're crazy? Whereas if an 18-year-old wants life insurance, they'll give it to him. Now, no one's going to say, well, gee, this 18-year-old hasn't been to college. He doesn't have a Nobel Prize. You know, we should give it to you. It doesn't work like that. You know, you get a chance to live. You make the best of you can, and then you move on. So I was, but quite frankly, people, when I, you know, I spoke like this and I tried to explain to them about indices like lives of, you know, years of life lost, YLL, years of life lost, or disability allowed life losses. These are things that insurance companies use. All doctors use this. If I went to my doctor and said, okay, I want a heart transplant. Gee, I'm a good guy. You know, maybe I'd get it at Stanford Medical School, but it wouldn't be fair. But the fact is that you've got to give people, you know, if you always let people who are older get more, then the young are never going to get a chance. And when, as a baby boomer, when I was growing up, I had it easy because all the people who were above me had the terrible time of growing up in the Great Depression or the Second World War. So, you know, it isn't fair. But for whatever reason, and I kind of fear that there'll be a backlash and that at some point the penny is going to drop and the young are going to say, okay, to keep somebody who's 85 alive for an extra 6 months, you've basically put me into a financial situation where I can't buy a house, my business has failed, you know, I'm not going to be able to afford healthcare for my kids. In other words, and it's not fair. So, but I still don't understand, you know, you could argue maybe it happened because most politicians are baby boomers, or maybe the media was spinning the story. It was very prevalent, especially in Israel, where, you know, no one dared to talk about the thing I've just said to you about years of life lost, or that perhaps, you know, a soldier killed in the line of duty at the age of 20 is more than somebody who's lived a very full life dying from corona, because everyone dies from something. You know, dying naturally of old age Nobody dies naturally of old age. And even if you die in your sleep, it might be a stroke, it might be a heart attack. So, you know, everyone dies of something. And just because you die with a little sticker on you saying COVID, that gets you onto the front page of the New York Times, whereas in the same period, another 600,000 people died in the USA from exactly the same age group, but they didn't die of COVID. So they didn't get memorialized. Now, if they had been, you know, soldiers in any of the wars, that's special. These are the people who have really given their lives. But, you know, no one who died of COVID really, well, and I think the hospital staff are different. Medical service people did give their lives to COVID, and they deserve, they're the heroes. But they wouldn't cover the front page of the New York Times. There might be 500 of them at the most. So I think there's a lot of, I would say dishonesty almost. I really don't believe that people really believe this. Although I must say, I'm very active on Twitter now, which I love. My Facebook friends, many of whom aren't my Facebook friends anymore, would not buy this. They felt that death was death and it didn't matter how old you were. So.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation. I was about to say, you know, because you're Israeli, you just speak the truth and shoot from the hip like my friend Ido Portal. But if you're saying even in Israel, they were not saying those things, then maybe I'm wrong. You know, it's this political correctness. It's almost that you'll emphasize these deaths for this reason, but you won't talk about the bigger picture. We see it in terrorist attacks all the time. A terrorist attack happened, 10 people died. Well, actually 10,000 people died yesterday due to heart disease, but we don't talk about that. So it's interesting. I think one of your studies, you said that even the deaths in Israel were kind of plus or minus 300 on the year. I think they were even down on the year, but no one talks about that figure. And like you said, if it's for COVID, they stick a sticker on you or you're on the front page of the New York Times, and all of a sudden it's pointed out. So there's a lot of weirdness that goes on with, I don't know, I guess it's emotion. Is that what's happening here that makes us focus on one thing and qualify others? Or is it politics?
I think there's something strange going on. I think some of it's politics. I think that, certainly in the USA, a lot of people who maybe wouldn't have, so for example, Dr. Anthony Fauci wrote in February that basically COVID was sort of like influenza. He didn't say it was identical to influenza, but it's not. It's a respiratory infection. It has a mortality that is similar. I mean, you know, certainly within 50% up or down of influenza. And the fact is that every two or three years, a lot of people die equally unpleasant deaths from influenza. But then, you know, dying from cancer isn't a lot of fun either. I think there's something strange going on because can you imagine, say, during the Second World War, if people had had this attitude? I mean, you know, we would be reporting every death. And I also felt, you know, in the United States, about 3 million people die every year. That is 100,000 a month. In the whole world, 150,000 die every day. If you take the entire death of COVID for the entire world, it's about 300,000 right now. That's 2 days worth. And I'm not making slight of that, but it puts things into perspective when people say that, you know, all the funeral homes in Italy are completely overwhelmed because of what ended up being 21,000 deaths. And then you work out in Italy every week, 1,700 people die. So this means that, you know, you get to those numbers quite easily. And I kept on trying to think, you know, who was benefiting from this? Maybe the hedge fund managers, maybe conventional media that is realizing that the rug is slipping out from underneath them and they want to catch eyeballs by being as sensationalist as possible. At one point, I thought it was nursing home owners, but they haven't done too well. So I guess they aren't very happy about what happened here. Or maybe they have done well. They've got lots of spare places now. But, you know, there's a kind of tradition of prolonging life. I mean, a lot of people have talked about the future. We would live forever or we would live to 150. And that's okay, but not at the expense of young people. And I think this is what we, you know, as I think as an old person, we have to look out for the world by standing up for the young people.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that perspective. I mean, I know in America as well, there was kind of financial gain for classifying as COVID-19, because I think you got the federal funding for the hospitals, and the hospitals, some of them are going bankrupt anyways because the rest of the wards were empty. And then I heard there was extra funding for putting them on a ventilator. And then, of course, it seems like the reclassification was, yeah, to the benefit of mainstream media for eyeballs or politicians to justify this medieval lockdown. Even in London now, it seems like, why haven't we stopped this lockdown? But it feels like if we stop it, it feels like they lose face because it makes them look like they made a bad decision. But I mean, the economic sacrifice doesn't seem worth it.
It definitely wasn't. You know, if you look at the economic sacrifice, and let's just say, so again, taking all of Europe where there's very good numbers, the total death toll from COVID in Europe, and Europe was definitely hard hit, is 30% more than the flu of 2017-18 in Europe. Now, that wasn't a particularly bad flu year. I think 2009 was worse, but I wanted to use exactly the same database, essentially on the same page they have the last 4 years. So they have COVID as a peak in the excess death, and then they have a peak in 17-18. And when you add those up, you find that the COVID it might still go down, but up till now it's about 30% higher than the flu, but it can well come down because there would be people who died. Now, when you look at those deaths, again, in the age group deaths from COVID are indistinguishable from those of flu. In both cases, 8% under 65, and in both cases, 50% over 85. So that is really the burden of death in Europe. And I think Europe is, and that includes England. I mean, you know, the United Kingdom is in there. So they're part of this whole thing. And then, you know, it may be worse in other countries, but that's sort of the excess. And it's not much, much worse than flu. Now, the economic burden it's not just the economic burden, but the economic burden is going to be huge. It's going to be very hard to restart economies. I've seen this in Israel, that now we're about a month out of the lockdown. A lot of people don't really want to work. It's interesting. I guess I've been working harder in the last 4 months ever before in my life.
Me too.
People have been reading, I'm sure. But, you know, a lot of people haven't. And, you know, and I like working. I love my job. But maybe if I was, you know, packing vegetables, I'd say, well, gee, you know, it's quite nice to be at home with my kids and so on. Then also there's a very big price socially. I think in Israel, there's been a lot more domestic violence. I think a lot of kids have had a hard time being with their parents. I know that in the United States, suicides are going up. In some ways, you know, it's been a massive tear in the social fabric. That may be a good thing. Usually after things like this, you get a reshuffling and people who were excluded can become included again. It's a very strange phenomenon, and one which makes me realize that the world better smart up very soon, because we've got some big ones coming down the pike. I mean, global warming is not going to be something like this at all. It's going to be infinitely worse.
And what about, or do you believe there will be another pandemic where there is something that's much worse?
I don't know. I think that it's very easy to predict disasters. People, you know, there's going to be a meteorite hit the earth. There's going to be an atomic explosion. There's going to be, and by and large, from my own experience, and I've lived for 73 years, you know, we got through the Cold War. We got through the massive arsenals of weaponry. We basically had a very good, the world has had a very, very good 70 years. And the fact is that things are better now than they've ever been before. They may be. I would actually hope that this will be a dress rehearsal for smartening up. And, you know, we need to start thinking a little bit more about, a little bit less about ourselves, maybe a little bit less focused about likes on social media, more about the real life. It was a thing that we were sort of drifting into a time when, you know, automation would take over all the work. We would be unemployed. People would live forever. And that no longer seems so likely. And it's a good thing it's not, because there's an awful lot of people for whom that wouldn't have been the model. That was the model for the, you know, top 1%. And I think we need to flatten our societies a bit, because societies that have massive inequalities are not really healthy places. It's interesting that in Europe, the two most sort of egalitarian societies are Iceland and Ireland. And they have, this is usually measured by something called the Gini Index. And the Gini Index for those two are really, really good. Other places are not nearly so good. And then you get to Brazil, and Brazil is the worst in the world. But Brazil is about probably 10 times less equal in terms of the richest to the poorest than Iceland or Ireland. And that has an effect. If you live in a country where there's this vast disproportionality, it leads to instabilities. And I think what we're seeing in the United States is a kind of instability. I don't know. But I'm not really worried too much about the future. The one thing I am worried about, I mean, in general, you know, you could say there's going to be another outbreak, but basically this one, for everything we've said about it, was, you know, up to 30% worse than flu. Okay, big deal. You know, I mean, that's important, but we can obviously, maybe next time flu comes along, we all wash our hands for the flu season. I mean, that would probably save a lot of deaths. Maybe there's a way to protect people in nursing homes. Maybe they shouldn't even go into nursing homes. Again, a complicated issue. The one that really worries me is global warming. I think, you know, I don't think anyone can stop the world from getting warmer in the next 50 years. I think nothing we can do is going to stop, you know, and it doesn't have to be catastrophic. We're already seeing unusual weather. I was in London in February. My mother lives in London. I was visiting her, and, you know, all the trees are blossoming, and, you know, it feels like spring, but it's February. I think global warming is a very interesting phenomenon, because most crises, you can't tell they're coming. But global warming is going to be a crisis that's coming. We don't know where it's going to hit, and it's going to be tough. It's going to be very tough, because most of the world will be much less inhabitable than it used to be.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that thought. You know, it's interesting what you say about people going back to work, because, you know, we're kind of opening up in London, I think, as of Monday. Non-essential businesses are being encouraged. And yet, I think a few things are happening. First of all, Professor, there's a lot of people that are still very scared. I feel like the fear campaign was way overdone. In fact, there was an article written in one of the papers that said they now need to have another campaign to get people out of their houses after the campaign to keep them in the houses. Luckily, I've been able to speak with people like you over the past 8 weeks, so I've never been in fear, but a lot of people are. At the same point, I think a lot of people have more gratitude in their lives, and they appreciate things that they didn't used to appreciate, people, social interactions. Maybe also they view the rat race in a different way. Maybe they don't want to work jobs. They hate to buy things they don't need, right? The classic Fight Club scenario. So I think there's that. But I do think we'll see cities fundamentally change. And like you said, in Israel and in London, it doesn't seem like anyone's rushing to get back here. And it's like you said, maybe I don't think the economy is going to snap back. And it is a new reality. And we're going to have to see, you know. And again, I just want to get your thoughts on the lockdown. I was surprised, too, that everyone fell in line. You know, if we had to do it all over again, would you do it where perhaps the older people were protected and the younger people stayed at work? Or, you know, how do you think we should have done the lockdown, or should we have?
Okay. So I've been in Israel since the end of February when I came here from London. And I was discussing lockdown with some pretty senior people here in the middle of March. And, you know, I told them, it's crazy to lock down the young people. What you should do is take all the young soldiers and put them on cruise ships and let them get well infected. Because for herd infection, you don't have to infect everybody. You know, if we manage to infect 25% more of the young people, you have very few deaths, and we'd basically be safe. Because getting old people infected is kind of a waste, because they're not very mobile. I mean, the point about the infected people is they dilute the pool, in the same way that if you had pre-existing immunity from common colds, you delete the pool. When I'm out there looking for somebody to infect, but if you have people who don't move around much, they don't help. But this was not considered. But I think in Israel, I felt that there were political reasons. But then every other country did the same thing. You know, I honestly don't know. I think sometimes when I'm feeling very Machiavelli, I would say that the virus here was the idea of lockdown. In the same way that we have computer viruses, you know, get money out of Nigeria and stuff like that. These are usually just stories that spread. And I think for whatever reason, people started to do lockdown, and I don't know whether it was politicians just enjoying the power, you know, we can make everyone stay at home, without realizing that this is a major responsibility. I think the social, you know, the sociology of what made everyone do it. Now, whenever you ask somebody, they say, well, we had to do it because, you know, Ireland says we had to do it because UK did it, and the UK says we did it because Italy did it. But if they actually looked at Italy, Italy was, you know, not such great lockdown. Italy locked down very, very late. And then, of course, we have Sweden. And Sweden is going to put egg on everybody's face because Sweden is going to end just where everyone else did. You know, so I think the lockdown is a truly strange phenomenon. Maybe some of your other speakers have addressed this, but it's something which I think is really, really interesting. It's almost like a psychosis a global psychosis. I always use the example of that radio broadcast in the 1930s when the Martians had landed and everyone panicked. You know, the leaders panicked, the people panicked, and then they just kept on reinforcing themselves. What surprised me was that I got a certain amount of hate mail. Some of the hate mail was just people who, you know, didn't know what they were doing. And what I actually did at one point, I took all the hate mail and I made one email of all the hate mail and I copied everybody. And that stopped them immediately because they all saw what other people had been writing and how silly it seemed. But I actually got some quite serious letters from scientific colleagues, some of whom are pretty high up. And they were very angry with me because they felt that by diminishing the threat of COVID, the other people, i.e. the inferior, you know, not academic people, would break the curfew and they would then infect me. And I said, you know, all this panic is killing people. I mean, when you're panicked, it messes up your immune system. So basically, you know, even if I'm wrong, I probably still save lives. And the logic here was very clear cut, but I learned a lot of things about others that I probably would have rather not learned.
About others, you mean? How so? With the hate mail, you mean?
Well, not just that. I think a lot of, you know, people have said that, well, firstly, I became a Twitter user. I'd never used Twitter before, and now I love Twitter. I mean, it's my favorite community. It's almost to the point now where I want to start getting some unpleasant feedback because everyone is so nice to me on Twitter. But I basically went from 20 followers to 16,000 followers in about 8 weeks. Of course, increasing exponentially. But I mean, it's been great. But FaceTime was, you know, my family members on this time got very upset with me. Friends on FaceTime. I think COVID is a bit like a contrast agent. When people do microscopy, in order to see cells more clearly, you put like orange dye on them. And then everything gets improves the contrast. And I think COVID is like a social contrast improver. Things that, you know, if you like, social divides that seem to be unimportant suddenly became important. Thoughts about healthcare that seem unimportant suddenly became important. I think a lot of liberties we took for granted suddenly became important. In certain countries, I think in Sweden, they actually couldn't have done a lockdown even if they wanted to. I think in Sweden, there are no emergency laws. And they could not have actually, you know, even if they really wanted a lockdown, all they could do is ask people to please lock down.
Right.
But the fact is that it's really, I see a lot of cracks in our society that weren't clear before.
Yeah, I saw that as well. And you learn about someone's character as well. How do you deal with fear? You know, and everyone deals with it differently. And sometimes the tough guys crack, and sometimes the ones you think aren't so tough, the ones that step up. You know, I'm sure you see this in military service in Israel and a lot of countries, you know, when the pressure is applied.
Yeah. But again, you know, for my own case sake, I always had the numbers. And, you know, right now we have more numbers than we've ever had. We've got writing a paper that's going to be submitted very, very soon. We've analyzed every single outbreak everywhere in the world. I mean, you know, so this is a completely global analysis. We're a little bit concerned about Brazil. Peru seems to perhaps be turning a corner. And in Europe, Europe is pretty much fine, except one worries about perhaps second waves in southern Italy, but I don't think so. I think second waves will not hit Europe. It's been infected enough.
And what we see Brazil, and I mean, obviously they kind of ignored it for a while, or the president was famous for really not even not even talking about it, not even admitting it was there. Is that the problem with Brazil? Because they didn't take the prophylactic measures?
No, I think the problem, Brazil is a big country.
Yeah.
It has a population that's about two-thirds of the USA. It's a big country, very diverse. You know, the number of deaths they have right now is, I think it's about 30,000. You know, they're still very much in growth phase. My guesstimates, but right now it's very difficult to estimate very accurately, they will probably top out at 100,000. And 100,000 will again be the same 500 per million. So, you know, we're seeing the same number. Now, again, you can get higher numbers if you make sure that every single corner is infected. Because I'm sure that in countries like France, some parts of France are less infected than other parts of France. Even in Italy, southern Italy and Sicily are way less affected than northern Italy. But by and large, this number. So I think it's going to be fine. And the other thing is also, I have had some video conferencing with Brazil because I kind of feel that they're, you know, no one really, people are no longer worried so much about COVID in the northern hemisphere. They're going to be fine as well. I don't see anything special about what they're doing or not doing. I was quite impressed by the scientists I talked to there.
Okay. Now, Professor, you're a scientist. What's your read on vaccines? I mean, I studied engineering. I was a science fair geek when I was a kid. And so for me, the science of vaccines always was attractive to me. I always got my vaccines. But in the past 8 weeks, I started speaking to people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and a lot of other doctors and started looking at the execution of vaccines and the vaccine industry and the lack of liability and et cetera. And now I'm really questioning if that is this ultimate solution. I'm wondering, have you looked into it, and what are your thoughts?
Well, I've you know, been on lots of panels, and I've heard people on the past Friday, there was a panel actually held by the European Molecular Biology Lab, where they actually reached out to scientists, and there were four of us. And one of the people was a vaccine expert with GlaxoSmithKline, and he said that, you know, to develop a vaccine actually takes about 20 years. And because vaccines are given to everybody, safety is incredible. So if a vaccine, you know, kills 100 per million, that's about the same level as COVID. You know, you can't tolerate that. He said that in past epidemics, when they rushed to make a vaccine, it was usually ready afterwards and not in time for the thing. Coronaviruses, you know, it would be a really good idea to make a vaccine against the common cold. I mean, the economic cost of common colds is huge. And if you could get vaccine once a year and common cold for that year, people would queue up for that. And they can't. So I just don't know. I think that, I mean, one would hope that science has improved. I, in some ways, it's very sad to say that we had a medieval lockdown. You know, we could have had a smart lockdown in many, many ways. And the phone could have been useful for other things than food delivery. And it really wasn't used that way. So I don't know. My feeling is that most of the Northern Hemisphere is okay, perhaps except for China. So the one country that has a massive need to get a vaccine is China. On the other hand, China might be able to control this in a smart way by people are very well monitored in China. Whenever you cross the road, you're photographed. My guess is the same cameras that are photographing you could easily take your temperature by putting in an infrared filter. Whenever you go to a store, you're photographed for temperature. People wear masks all the time. Right now in Shanghai, people are wearing masks and might continue wearing masks for the foreseeable future, certainly on the underground and things like that. So they might get away with it, but they really would like, I'm sure, to have a vaccine. So maybe that's where the incentive will come.
Why does China need it? Why does China need it more than anyone?
Because they haven't been infected yet. I mean, if you look at the USA, the infection rate is a couple of 100 per million. In China, the infection rate in China is, I'm going to do the math, maybe 5 per million?
Right.
No, it's small because the total number of deaths is 5,000 to 1.5 billion. I mean, it's very, very small. I think it's 3 per million. Something terrible.
Right. It's like Australia and New Zealand. They're so happy because they don't have cases, but it also means that they're susceptible to the virus, and ultimately it's going to get there.
Sorry, you dropped out there. I didn't
get that. Was, you know, we've seen Australia and New Zealand kind of celebrate they have no new cases, but also the population hasn't been subjected to it. And sooner or later, you have to open up those countries, don't you?
Yeah, I think that this, again, is something which there are a few countries in that category, Norway, Austria, New Zealand, Israel, Australia, who really seem to have got away with, you know, good lockdowns. And maybe it's not a good idea, but, you know, I don't know. Maybe if there's enough people who have immunity and they check incoming, I think islands are relatively easy to protect. Israel, again, is also relatively easy because it has no land borders. And, you know, so you either come in on a boat or an aeroplane. I think that for me, the really interesting situations are none of those. They're Japan and Taiwan, because both of them, now Taiwan, I think, just kept it out and had very few cases. But Japan has had a few thousand deaths, which is tiny for that population size of 100 million, but also for the number of aged people. I mean, China has more old people than Italy had. And for whatever reason, Japan is controlling it. And I think there's a secret there for all of it. I don't know what it is. It may just be, and it's a high density country, but maybe people in Japan keep to themselves. I don't know. No, I don't know the answer.
Right, but there's something there.
It's a very interesting question to ask somebody.
No, it is. And so, I mean, honestly, a vaccine that's been tested is probably 5, 10, 20 years off. It's not realistic. It's something I think politicians talk about, but I think that's just to put the population at ease or make it look like they're doing something. But I personally don't think, I don't think you would want to take a vaccine that's been tested even for a year or two. Would you?
No, I'd much rather get Corona. You know, seriously. I mean, you know, if somebody came along and said, you know, well, would you like to get Corona? I'd say, sure. You know, I'd, if somebody said, if you get Corona, you can travel freely, I would go and take it immediately.
And it's probably just as dangerous as a vaccine at this point.
Yeah, or common flu. I mean, one thing about being old is that the chance of you dying from health-related things is quite high. It's way higher for me than it would be for a 20-year-old. But that's actually quite, you know, relieving, because basically I can do risky things right now because the incremental risk is actually very small. So if I had a motorcycle, it would probably only increase my risk by 10%. But if I was 20 and I had a motorcycle, it would double my risk. So, you know, when you're old, you do have a risk of dying. On the other hand, no one can take away from you what you've had. So, you know, it's important to see things this way. And I really am speaking very sincerely. I'm not trying to, you know, sound like, gee, you know, the guy is really so scared, because I do really feel that, you know, life or otherwise, and, you know, then you need to make space for other people. So,
yeah, I appreciate the point of view. It's like almost like the way an actuary would look at it. And it's funny you said that, because I've heard from people here over 80 who said, I don't want to stay away from my grandkids for 6 months because I might only have a year left and I want to enjoy it.
Yeah. And the fact remains that those old people, you know, it turns out that the risk of dying from coronavirus at any age is like having double the normal risk for 1 month. I actually said this in the LA Times article, but that's what the numbers look like. If you take, basically, the normal death rate is around 1 in 100. So that is 10,000 per million. So corona is maybe 1/10 or 1/15 of the normal death rate. So it's basically death for 1 month instead of death for 1 year. So all the deaths in Europe are exactly 3 weeks of normal death. And Europe was very badly hit. So this basically means that by living normally, your risk for 1 month ahead is doubled. But it's like saying, gee, I'm so scared of the risk for the next month, I'm not going to live. We are, and you know, if you're older, then your risk is doubled, but it's doubled for you. So, you know, you'll have a higher risk. So that's why 85-year-olds has a pretty high risk. At my age, I think I have a 0.5% chance of dying every month. I think I was 85 would be 1.5%. Now, that's quite a lot. That's 15, maybe 20% a year. I think in nursing homes, die every year. Normally, not from COVID. This is just the normal background death rate. Right. And it seems to me for every individual, you know, we don't go out of our way to control the normal background death rate. If somebody said, you know, if you stop eating, drinking and everything, you know, lay in your bed, you know, you'd live an extra 6 months. You wouldn't want that. I mean, you know, because dying is part of life, a very natural part of life. So, you know, in Israel at one point, they wanted to say, well, we're going to, all the old people still have to be locked down. And I said, you know, I'm not going to be locked down. You know, they can catch me. I don't mind. I'll pay the fine. You know, I accept the risk. It's a natural risk of life. Yeah. Double for 1 month.
Yeah. Now, that's a really good perspective. Professor, can I ask you a question? What's it like to win a Nobel Prize? And does it change your life? Does it not? Is it something you aspired to? Or is it just a result of doing what you love?
So basically, just to start at the end, I think it's something you should never aspire to because it's an unpredictable thing. And there are people who, you know, on the 10th of October, whatever the day is, are always listening to the television. For them, it's like Groundhog Day, you know, gee, I thought I was going to get it. I didn't get it. I did not expect it at all. About changing your life, it actually depends where you're living. Because the Nobel Prize is, well, no, surprise, not changing your life. The surprise aspect, what's it like? Depends where you live. If you live in Europe, you know, it's announced in Sweden at noon, you hear it again or something like that, no big deal. If you're on the East Coast at 6 a.m., but if you're in California, it's 3:15, it's 2:15. And unless you're one of those who sit up to see how they didn't get it each year, you know, you're asleep. So I was asleep in California. I remember looking at the clock, it was 2:16, and I was asleep. It's a big surprise. I mean, it's a true high, you know, 15 cups of espresso type high. Then after a week, you sort of say, well, gee, I keep on saying the same nonsense. It's way more boring to talk about what you did in the past than to talk about perspectives of coronavirus, because it's actually current, you know, it's not about me, it's about the world. And you know, your opinion is just the same as mine. If I'm talking to you about my past, you know, big deal. But I think that what is interesting is that after a while, you suddenly realize, gee, for the past week, I haven't actually thought. You know, talking about your past is not really thinking. It's regurgitating. And you suddenly realize that being able to think is a real luxury in life. Then you also realize, well, I'm exactly the same as I was a week ago. Why should I change my life? But then one thing kicks in. When I was 18, 19, 20, I came to England as a student from South Africa. And I met the most incredible Nobel Prize winning scientists. People like Francis Crick, whom I worked with, who discovered the DNA. I mean, just people who were like the greatest of, you know, up there in the Einstein class. And I suddenly realized that I thought these guys were gods. No, they weren't. They probably felt exactly the same as I did. Oh, what a drag. You know, I want to go home and I want to have my dinner and whatever. But realized that people who have been recognized in this way, have been touched in this way, have a duty to actually try to infect other people with a passion for science. And so, you know, then you just basically do it. You give lectures. My current lecture is entitled A Wonderful Life in Science, because I do think I've had a wonderful life in science. And, you know, science is full of surprises. It's cool because you also meet people of all ages. You don't really feel that you're, you know, necessarily getting too old because your students are always the same age. And so there's a lot of good things about it. So actually, it does change your life, but I think it changed your life by giving you an extra dimension. I also think that this, my sort of desire or getting involved in Corona like this has been a feeling that I'm allowed to speak out. No one's going to cut me off. And if they do, you know, it's going to be hard for them. And since I'm not saying anything that is, you know, truly disagreeable, I'm just, everything I'm saying is backed by numbers. It's my duty to try and speak up for sanity. I must say, I was very disappointed that none of my colleagues, you know, Nobel Prize winners meet each other all the time. We go to meetings together, we, you know, do stuff like that together. And I was about the only one who really went out on a limb. And, you know, people said to me, you're not an epidemiologist. And I said, well, you know, I understand data. And I've worked on dynamic systems all along, so there should be no deal about this. But it was also an obligation. You could actually make the following thing. So take Britain. A decision was made to lock down. That's a hard decision. It's not a decision. It's a very, very hard decision to make. And that should have been preceded by a meeting of 20 of the best minds in the country, of all kinds, you know, lawyers, sociologists, business people. We want as maximum people in broadcasting, people who actually think. And then the decision should have been made. Instead, it looks like it was a decision made, you know, maybe pushed by one or two scientists based on unsure information. Information is always unsure. Information has to be tested. I have tried very hard from the very beginning. So I started on the first thing I published was on the 2nd of February. And then I just sent out these reports every day to China. By the middle of March, I had a much bigger report. And I sent it to people saying, engage with me. You know, don't tell me it's nonsense. It's easy to do the calculations yourself. You know, get out Excel. Let's do it together. There was almost no engagement. And I think that is also a failing of society, because hard problems are way better solved by a group of people than by one person. Committees are actually very good, if they're well set up, are very good at solving problems. So there have been some shortcomings.
Yeah, well, you're right, though. I mean, having that, you know, Nobel Prize behind your name does mean that people aren't necessarily going to cut you off and they'll listen to the numbers. And if it is about the numbers, then it's hard to argue with those. So that's why I think, you know, your voice has kind of risen. And when you articulate yourself, it just makes a lot of sense. But I guess the norm in science maybe is not to do that, to not stick your head above the parapet and to kind of move as the group.
And you could make the argument that I'm, in some sense, I have immunity in the language we've been speaking, because, you know, no one's going to be able to take away what I've already had. And, you know, I can do that. But I think that everyone had this obligation, at least to discuss it, you know, not to shut things down. It was a huge amount of shutting. It was lockdown. Lockdown wasn't just at home. It was lockdown of people's minds. It was a general sort of lockdown, you know, turn off the switch. And not discuss it. But people were frightened. I mean, the sort of, because even the other thing that's amazed me is the level of censorship that's practiced by, I mean, your channel is obviously very aware of this, but videos that go into YouTube and then disappear. And, you know, again, I'm not going to get political. You know, Twitter has been great. But it seems to me that you have to be, you know, if you say anything that goes against what the World Health Organization said is not allowed, well, that's not a good thing to say, because a lot of what they said actually wasn't correct. And, you know, they were very much against masks at first. And then a few days ago, it was asymptomatic cases don't infect. We don't know the answer. I think the real answer in science is usually we don't know. Let's discuss it. And that's always like that. Yeah. Probably true in many walks of life.
I had a Dr. Michael Greger on a couple days ago. He's a scientist, kind of a big advocate of a plant-based diet. But he said in science, the solution to bad information is more information, you know, not less information. And, you know, we've really felt the censorship in the last 9 weeks. For 9 years, I was never censored on any social media platform. And yet when we started talking about COVID-19, when we started talking about implications of 5G, and when I used the V word for vaccine, literally pretty much everything was shut down, and our entire channel, really? A quarter billion views has been threatened to be deplatformed on YouTube. So that's why we're on this digital freedom platform right now, because Professor, a lot of the things that we talk about would be removed, and then I would be deplatformed because I've made so many violations. And again, these are scientists, doctors who've been in the field 20 years, Robert F. Kennedy, who's been studying, you know, vaccines for 20 years, talking with scientific study backing, and yet it still goes against policies, community policies of these big platforms. If you ask me why, I don't even want to go down in that rabbit hole, because, but there are people out there.
It's not clear.
It's not clear. I would say that, you know, the pharmaceutical companies definitely have power over the mainstream media, because I've been told by Robert F. Kennedy that in a non-election year, they're 70% of the advertising budget. So they kind of have this implicit, let's not talk about these things that might affect. Also in America, as you know, in America, they're, you know, these 2-minute long ads for these drugs you've never heard of. I mean,
you know, one thing that hasn't been spoken about is that the people who die from influenza or COVID often die from bacterial infections. The lung gets messed up and then bacteria get in there. And in some ways, these big pharma companies no longer put any money whatsoever into antibiotics. And that is, so if you really wanted to make a case against them, would be that a lot of these deaths we're getting now are due to the lack of development of antibiotics. And the reason is that antibiotics don't pay. It's a 10-day course. if you wanted to charge a lot of money for an antibiotic, the government would stop you. The drugs that are really good drugs are drugs that would give me, as a cancer patient, an extra half a year of good life when I'm 85 years old. I would definitely pay $500,000 for it, especially since this is my kid's money. So, you know, what's the big deal? And I actually feel quite bad because I did some work in the 80s on antibody therapy for cancer. And some of the very, very popular high-selling cancer drugs like Avastin or Herceptin are actually made with a patent that I helped write in 1989. And it's to do with the fact of how you make antibodies in mice and then you give them a makeover so that they're okay for people. And those drugs, you know, have a lot of ethical challenges because they're very expensive drugs. They're expensive to make, but they're great for the big pharma companies because, you know, it's much easier. There's no regulation. I mean, you know, it's much better to have a very expensive drug for a small audience than a very cheap drug for a big audience. Safety matters, et cetera. That's why vaccines are kind of like the last thing you want to be working on.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was, funny enough, just talking to Dr. Greger, and he said, you know, the most popular appointment for a doctor's office is a blood pressure check, because then they can adjust the levels of statins that you're on. And the statin is the blood pressure drug that probably most Americans are on, and you'll take the rest of your life. And so the pharmaceutical companies love it. They pay the doctors to do it. The food industry would rather you have that red meat so you need it. Then they give the money to the politicians. So I don't like to go down the conspiracy level, but the point is that it's in everyone's financial interest, including the BMW dealership that sells the doctor the car, for this to continue in status quo. And if people speak against it, I think the forces kind of push it out. And I think,
well, you know, a very funny counterexample was that paper in Lancet on chloroquine.
Yes.
And that's a very interesting case because I think well, basically, it was a paper. I mean, chloroquine has been recommended in certain circles, and I think a lot of people probably don't take those recommendations very seriously. But in any case, it was decided to do clinical studies of chloroquine, and then paper was released basically pointing out all sorts of side effects of this clinical study that were actually wrong. So they stopped the clinical study, and then I think the Guardian newspaper looked into it and found that the statistics was all messed up. So basically, they had fabricated this case against chloroquine. They got the paper put into a very high-profile journal very, very quickly, and then it was wrong. Now, this puts, you know, a lot of people have egg on their faces now because I keep on trying to imagine the inverse. Imagine you had a paper that showed chloroquine was actually very useful. That would never have been fast-tracked into a journal.
Right.
I probably could have talked about it very quickly on Fox News. So you suddenly see these party lines, and it's very unpleasant. I mean, it's not just a two-way thing. It's a multi-way thing. It's big pharma, it's the big data companies. It's global things. It's actually a real pity because you don't solve in how you deal with COVID is a difficult problem. It's a difficult problem like, relativity is a difficult problem. We don't, you know, you have to make very difficult decisions. And clouding it with politics doesn't help. We could not have designed an atomic bomb in the United States if it had been a political thing. It would never have worked.
Yeah.
And politicians have to realize this, and I hope they do soon. I mean, been turned over.
Yeah, well, I mean, like you said, with that orange marker, this whole crisis has shown me the actual information war that we're in and how there's a lot of parties out there that they want to control this flow of information. And the war is being fought in your living room, on your phone, and it's sometimes controlled with your own digital identity. And you don't even know sometimes the opinions you're forming are being formed by others. And this is like the new reality, you know? You know, back when you were born, you know, the only warfare we knew was, you know, there's the enemy, shoot him. But now it's really changed. And it's going to be an interesting
thing. I think in some ways, but it's, you know, I think on the other hand, I've been very impressed by Twitter. I think that Twitter actually people are actually working with me. You know, people are now adopting the methods I talked about. They're running analyses. I'm getting a lot of direct messaging. It's like having a group for nothing. You know, I have a large group of people working as volunteers to me. And, you know, all that I have to do is just be interested in what they're doing. It's actually like the ideal sort of Athenian ideal of, you know, people working because they love it. And we'll see. I think these things cut all ways. And, you know, I remain optimistic. I guess I can probably till I die.
Yeah, last question I wanted to ask you, Professor. Your upbringing is fascinating. You know, born in South Africa to parents from Lithuanian descent. You moved to London. You went to school here. You quickly visited Israel and I think maybe fell in love with that. Obviously, you teach and study or did at some point in California. How much of that shaped the man you are today?
I think it did. I think as I said, I'm not somebody who's, you know, is a tribalist. I don't believe in my side being the best, because actually I have multiple sides. Also, I actually feel, you know, you can enjoy fish without saying I don't like meat, or you can, you know, like vegetables without saying I never eat. You know, you can actually like things without excluding other things. I never see actually the reason to exclude. I believe that diversity really is a massive secret for all of life. We have to be very diverse, because survival depends on diversity. In the same way, the survival of your portfolio that you invested depends on diversity. If it's all Bitcoin, you know, you might do really well, but you're going to get into trouble at some point. So I really believe in globalism. My nature is, you know, right now we also spend time in China because my wife is a curator of Chinese art. And, you know, China's just another country. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that I'm not going to talk about politics. But on the other hand, you know, there's a lot of good things there, very efficient. So, you know, I think one sees lots of different things. I think actually, you know, I don't think anyone has yet found the perfect system for anything. We still have to find better social systems, better systems of governance. You know, one closing word that I actually have said before, but I like very much, and that is that, you know, people have been talking about a future where machines are doing a lot of things. But what we really need machines for is not to do the manual work, but to do a bit of the thinking. And I have this sort of dream that in 10 years' time, before the next big crisis, artificial intelligence will have come a long, long way. And in the same way that now when we want to drive anywhere, we open up Google Maps or Waze or whatever the routing program is, and we don't even try to prove how great we are at driving, we just say, you know, get us to this place. Well, I think what we need to do next time is to put our phone on and basically say, hey, Alexa, Google, Siri, should I panic? And you'll get an answer coming back that would say, you know, you probably shouldn't panic because you're this age group and the mortality is like this and people are working on it over here. And if you follow this link, you'll get good information, take it easy. I mean, that isn't rocket science, but that would have saved a lot of people a lot of panic. And, you know, I think it's an important way to think about this.
I've heard you quote Socrates by saying, I think, use your common sense instead of listening to rhetoric. Is that how that goes?
Yeah. I mean, basically, that's what Socrates did say. I mean, in fact, it was interesting. I was on Fox, and a lot of my, Laura Ingraham, who's actually a very nice lady, smart as well. And a lot of my people had said, how can you go into Fox and stuff like this? And actually, you know, we were talking about common sense and rhetoric, which I think is a very important rule here, because I think a lot of us forget about our common sense. And you know, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. And you know, we do have, and there was information out there. Now, you know, I worry because in any kind of environment, you always seek out people who are like you. And you shouldn't, you should actually seek out people who are different from you, because that's the interesting part. And I kind of wish I'd been, you know, maybe more. In fact, the first interview I had was with, I forget the name, Brian has a Fox radio show, Brian Kilmeade. And I was on Brian Kilmeade on the 3rd of March, which was very early. And, you know, he had me talking for 20 minutes, didn't interrupt me once. I don't think it got any, you know, I never heard anything back from it. I probably didn't get any views or any likes, but it was a very nice experience. So, you know, I think it's a diverse world out there, and we need to be diverse to make the best of it.
Yeah, very much so. And I know what you mean by common sense. I see things sometimes and, you know, plexiglass between tables, and it just doesn't make any common sense to me. Last question, Tel Aviv, for people that have never been there before, what's the city like? How would you describe it to someone from somewhere halfway across the world?
So I would say it's like New York and Casablanca mixed together. we have a great seafront. I mean, you know, the long edge of Tel Aviv is the ocean. It's a very nice sea. I go walking there almost every evening. It basically feels like a festival. We were there last evening, and I actually got a Burning Man. I don't know if you know about what Burning Man is, but I go there. And the Tel Aviv seafront actually feels like Burning Man. There's great music and lights and, you know, people walking around with their bathing suits on and stuff like that. And then further inland, you have, you know, some beautiful architecture, high skyscrapers, a lot of art. I mean, in that sense, it's a bit like New York. I mean, it's not, it's very small compared to New York. It doesn't have anything like the galleries, but it's a pretty exciting art scene, music scene, theater scene with the beach. So it's like, you know, if Jones Beach was in, if New York had a lower latitude and Jones Beach was one edge of Manhattan, that would be Tel Aviv. So,
well, I had a great time there 3 years ago when I was filming a documentary with one of your countrymen, Ido Portal. I will send you a copy of that movie.
And, please do. I would love to see it.
Yeah, you'll love him. You can go practice with him physically. You'd really enjoy it. He showed me there's the statue of, is it Gefilde Christ sitting on his head on the beach, right?
Yes.
That, so.
But is it Feldenkrais or Ben-Gurion? I think it's
maybe it's Ben-Gurion who practiced Feldenkrais. Yeah, that was it. So we walked by there.
And practice yoga. Yeah, yeah.
We filmed.
Yeah, I think I was there yesterday.
Okay. We filmed the whole conversation walking down the beach there. So fantastic. Professor, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you putting your ideas out there. And again, using the platform that you have to really get these controversial ideas out there. It means a lot. Please come see us in London for our next conversation.
I will do.
And keep doing what you do. I really appreciate you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to check you guys out. You're a very good interviewer. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much, sir.
Bye-bye for now.
All right. Bye-bye. For everybody watching us, if you could please share this link in the sidebar to all your friends and family, put it on the social. These are great ideas. And we'll see you this Sunday, of course, and every Sunday at London Real. Thank you so much. Bye.